announcement, and I'm an idiot. The reason I'm an idiot is that when we planned this conference, in order to make it more fun, since I was one of the attendees last year, I commented that I came here and I had absolutely no idea what the string theorists were talking about. That's not why I'm an idiot. It might demonstrate it, I don't know. But I said, you know, we really ought to have some sort of way of getting cross-pollination between the fields. And Lee said, that's a great idea. And 2 days later, I get an email from Mike Mosca saying, how would you like to give an introduction to quantum information? Well, yeah. So those of you who know anything about quantum information may know that this is actually the title of Michael Nielsen and Ike Twang's textbook on the topic. Yes? Probably not. But if it was, we'll find out later. This is the title of Mike and Ike's textbook. It's about 700 pages long or so. I've volunteered to give a talk with the same title that is 39 more minutes long. So obviously there's going to be a little bit of abbreviation here. I realized last night, first of all, how little I really know about this field after studying it for 7 years. And then as I started to try to fit my slides into one talk, I realized how much I actually know. Very disturbing to know, realize how little you know, and yet you can't possibly convey it in 40 minutes. So what I'm going to try to do is give you a combination of a couple of things. The first is the background to understand the language that people giving quantum information, and maybe to some degree quantum foundations talks, will be using. Inevitably, some of this will be incredibly stultifyingly review for some of you, and some of the rest of you will probably be baffled by what I'm saying. Those of you who are bored, please just be quietly bored. Those of you who are baffled, please feel encouraged to ask me short, to-the-point questions. I reserve the right to take any question that requires more than 5 seconds of thinking and postpone it until the end of the talk. Those of you who are really experts in quantum information, only contradict me on the really glaringly wrong things. The other things just, you know, yeah, talk to me later. Okay, so what I want to start out by doing is presenting sort of the foundations of what the heck quantum information theorists are actually doing. This is the part, by the way, where if you're an expert in the field, you don't get to contradict me, because this is just my opinion about why we're doing what we're doing. So, okay, quantum information. What the heck is information? Well, first of all, it's related to the fact that my laser pointer isn't working. There we go. Several catchphrases I like for defining what information is. The first, this is the fun one, something that tells you something about something else. The great thing about that one is it's almost impossible to contradict it because it's so incredibly vague. It does, however, capture the idea. I'm going to use the other principles here to kind of clarify what I mean by that. The first is Rolf Landauer's quote, information is physical. This is of great importance to quantum information theorists, a little bit less to classical information theorists, though it applies there as well. The point is, when I say that information is something that tells you something about something else, the thing that it tells you about is going to be some physical system in which you are interested, and the thing that tells you something about it, that is going to be another physical system. So at the physics level, what we're studying here is physical systems and what they tell us about each other, which if you think about it for maybe 15 seconds, is a fairly relevant question, since we go through the world as physicists. Are there any experimentalists in the room? Show of hands. Oh, dread. Okay. If you were experimentalists, you would go through the world finding out about actual physical systems. As theorists, you go through the world predicting what experimentalists will find out about actual physical systems. But actually, on a day-to-day basis, we do a lot of experimental physics. Every time, for instance, we pick up a coffee cup and say, ooh, that was hot, and everything else about our lives. The point of this being that quantum information people tend to be interested also in quantum foundations, which addresses questions like, how the heck is this quantum stuff that we observe compatible with the everyday stuff that we do? So the second, or the third, I guess, quote I want to use is, this is actually my favorite definition. Information is a resource to reduce uncertainty. So the something that something tells you about something else is something that has predictive power. In fact, it is predictive power. The whole point of information is that one physical system possesses a resource that allows you to predict something about some other physical system that you're interested in. If you happen to be an astronomer, this might be photons coming in, allow you to predict something about stars way off in the distance. I can come up with about 600 other examples, but I hope you've gotten the picture. The last definition is a little bit more technical, though shorter, correlation. This is how one physical system tells you something, allows you to predict something else. So let me try to give a short example of this. Suppose that I tell you I'm thinking of a number between 0 and 1. Okay, so usually this would be between 0 and 100, but, well, we're going to talk about bits later on, so between 0 and 1. This is inclusive. And then I say, so what's the number? Well, of course, you know that I know inside my head there's a number. But what's the number? Who knows? You don't. I do. But suppose that I were to haul out a sheet of paper. I was going to bring one up here. Okay. Imagine I have a sheet of paper, and I write down my number on the sheet of paper. And I don't show it to you. So you still don't know what's in my head or what's on the sheet of paper. But the point is, you do know something. What you know is that the number on the paper and in my head are the same. Again, you don't know which. But you do know that there's correlation here. If I wanted to write down a state describing the state of the physical system on this white blob there, I might write a probability distribution where I say, well, I know that either they both say 0 or they both say 1, but I don't know which. Yes? Sorry. When I said a number between 0 and 1, I meant a natural number, or an integer between 0 and 1. Sorry. 0 or 1. That's it. Really simple. Okay. So if here what I'm drawing is the probability for my brain to be in a particular state. On the other axis, the probability for the paper to be in a particular state. The point is that the paper carries information about the internal state of my brain, and it does it because the two are correlated, even though I don't actually know either one. And so the interesting thing here is that information actually corresponds to ignorance as well. If you don't, you know everything, then nothing can add information about everything else, because information is a resource that you use to reduce uncertainty. You have to have some uncertainty in the first place. This is a classical description of this because, well, pieces of paper in my brain are both classical as far as I know. If I wanted to write down a quantum state with the same properties, I could write down something like this, and I'll come back to the differences between these a little bit later. So there's the warm, fuzzy introduction to roughly what information is, why we're interested in it from a physical perspective. Now let me start providing a little bit more technical background stuff. Classical information is information about classical systems. In other words, it's correlation between classical systems. There have to be at least two to be correlated. Conventionally, we're going to call them A and B, just because we're not very creative. We could call them P and W, but that would get confusing because everybody would pick different conventions. So I might have a probability distribution over some variables X sub A that describe the A system, and some variables X sub B. That probability distribution, as I showed in the last slide, can be correlated. In that case, there is some information about one of them in the other one. The point here is that when you do classical information theory, you focus on probability distributions. Those are the states that classical systems can take on. The kinematics of information is, roughly speaking, represented by what are the possible states for a classical system. Dynamical questions in information theory come down to what are the maps that can be implemented on those states. The central focus to me of information theory is what kind of correlations can you produce or achieve between physical systems. So sometimes you produce those correlations as intermediaries to use to achieve some result. Sometimes you produce those correlations directly to achieve a particular result. Two different forms of this question are, what kind of correlations can you achieve between different systems at the same time? And what can you do with those correlations? The turning that around, we can ask, what kind of correlations can I achieve between the input and the output of some process? This is a nod to computation. So here, I'm not really concerned about space-like correlations, but time-like correlations and how those develop between the input and output of this process. So within this realm of probability distributions and classical and quantum states, what do we actually care about? What do we spend most of our time thinking about? We think about transformations. Every question that I know of in information theory comes down to some form of transformation. How can you transform correlations from one form into another? For instance, suppose that I have some information about a very large system, and I want to store this in a smaller place, perhaps because my hard drive has gotten full. How can I cram that into a smaller system without actually losing any of that information? This is compression. Another question is, suppose that I have some information. That's my information. How would I transform it into your information? This is communication. Communication is simply a transformation that turns one kind of information into another. Those happen to live at different places and presumably in different systems. Getting a little bit more technical, how could we transform one person's information? By the way, okay, if you have two parties in an information theoretic game, one of them is always called Alice and the other one is always called Bob. And if there's somebody in the middle, they're always called Eve. It's a convention. There are interesting stories about how this started, but it's something to be aware of. A while back, what's that? Well, that's complex. Now you got three-person protocols, and I'm not going to worry about Charlie, at least not for the moment. These are the basics. This is information theory 001 or something. Charlie is at the higher level. So cryptography is the question, how do you transform information that's held by one party into information that's held by another party, but not held by Bob and Eve together? Then there's a question of, what if you don't want anything to happen to your information at all, which sounds incredibly boring, but is actually quite a challenge, especially in quantum information theory. Protecting your information against unwanted transformations is error correction. And finally, something I'm not doing sufficient justice to in this summary at all, computation is transforming one representation of information into another representation of the same information. For instance, I might be given two integers, and I want to transform those two integers into their sum. For those of you who are sort of thinking through this physically, this is not a faithful representation of the initial information, right? Because I've lost some information along the way, and we frequently do that. But if you like, I could stick on A plus B and A minus B, and then I have a faithful representation of the initial information. I know everything that I initially did by looking at the output, but it's in a different form. So this is an addition algorithm. Pause. Any questions? Okay, great. That must mean I'm boring, so I should speed up. Okay, so what's quantum information? I told you what classical information is, vaguely speaking. Quantum information is just information about quantum systems. In other words, it's correlation between quantum systems represented by quantum states. So the incredibly brief review of quantum states as we see them in quantum information theory. I'm assuming that everybody here knows quantum mechanics, but you may be coming from different backgrounds, and I honestly don't know. So the first thing is we usually think about finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So quantum systems that have a discrete valued observable. We also do work with continuous valued systems like photons in free space, but one of the basic assumptions that most quantum information and computation theorists make is that you can always represent the state of a continuous system with very high fidelity, in other words, very faithfully, on some discrete Hilbert space. For instance, if you have a harmonic oscillator, this is a continuous system, but you can generally truncate the Hilbert space, if you represent it in terms of the number eigenstates of the harmonic oscillator, you can just sort of chop that off at some point and say, the probability that I'm going to find the system in this incredibly high energy eigenstate is so small that I'm just going to ignore those and map the whole problem onto a finite dimensional Hilbert space. So this is one of the basic tricks that we do. Is anybody not? Show of hands. Who's familiar with Dirac notation, bras and cats? Okay, I'm going to take that as being enough. I'm sorry if you're not. That's a quantum state. So all the quantum states that I'm interested in can be written out in some basis. Two systems combine, remember I was talking about joint states of systems that have two subsystems, you combine via tensor product. So if I've got one state like this and another state like this, the state of the joint system is just a tensor product of the two. So I've got a basis of states here that label the first system with I and the second system with J, and then a bunch of coefficients that are the product of the amplitude for one system and of the amplitude for the other system. However, I can have states of the joint system that aren't tensor product states. So here I've got an arbitrary set of amplitudes out front of this basis. If they can't be decomposed as a product like that, then that state has correlation between the two systems. It's not quite as simple as that, because generally we operate under uncertainty. Pure states are great if you know exactly what the state is. If you actually want to use these things for information processing tasks or really just about anything, you have to say, well, I don't actually know exactly what the state is. So in the presence of uncertainty, I describe the state of the quantum system. By the way, I think I can feel Chris folks wanting to correct my grammar here. But if I'm not certain what pure state describes the system, then I describe it by a mixed state. So I take the projectors onto all of the pure states that it could be, and I sum them up to get an operator, a density operator, that describes a somewhat less known state of the quantum system. Finally, I'm skipping over vast numbers of things here, so again, please do feel free to ask questions along the way. If I have a joint system described by a density matrix for system A and system B, then I can find the state describing a subsystem of that by what's called a partial trace. By instead of tracing out the entire density matrix, which would give me one, because the trace of a density matrix is the total probability, I trace out one half. I'm not going to actually go into the mechanics of this, but this is the procedure where you start with a single, perhaps a pure state of a bipartite system. You write it as a density matrix, which in this case would have just one term, and then you take out most of the components and sum over them to get a reduced state for a subsystem. This is one of these fundamental primitives in quantum information theory. Okay, so this is the kinematics, the possible states. Dynamical questions are about what transformations can you implement on states. So here's a brief list of the possible things that you can do to a quantum system. One of them I hope is fairly familiar to everybody, unitary dynamics. This is what happens if you have a Hamiltonian and you have e to the iht, et cetera, et cetera. Your pure state turns into a different pure state. If you have a density matrix, it just rotates in the Hilbert space, doesn't change the spectrum of that density matrix, by getting sandwiched between U and U dagger. Another kind of dynamics that I can have that we don't actually think about all that much is an extension. This is really easy. You start with some initial state and you add on some fixed state of another system. So physically what this corresponds to is, here I've got a system, I say, aha, here's another system. Let's think about them together. It's one of the least interesting things you could do. But when you put it together with other things, in particular when you put it together with a unitary transformation, you get what's called an isometry, which is essentially a unitary that maps you from an initial state, psi 0, to a final state on a larger Hilbert space. And the way you get this is by tacking on what's called an ancilla, an extra system, and then performing a unitary on the whole thing. So this is how systems interact with their environments, for instance. It's how we describe noise processes in quantum information theory. And if you want to describe the final state of just the system that you were initially interested in, not its state together with its environment, then you have to do what I said in the previous slide, which is trace out that environment. So this kind of map is called a reduction. You start with some large state of both A and B, you end up with a reduced state just of A. It's worth noting that for the first three here, I gave how you write down this map, both for pure states and for mixed states. Here, I'm only giving the formula for mixed final states, and the reason is you don't necessarily get a pure state when you perform a reduction. In other words, when you throw away part of a system, if that system was if the part that you threw away was correlated with the part that you kept, you always get a mixed state. So I can't necessarily write down a version of this with a pure output state. Yes?
Why did I know somebody was going to ask that?
Okay. So I'll get to that in just a second. Thank you for bringing that up. The most general, barring things that were just brought up, map that I can have on a quantum system turns out to be one, and this is non-trivial to say that this is the most general, one where I perform three steps. First, I take my initial state and I tack on an ancilla, an environment, which can be arbitrarily big. Then I do a unitary rotation of both of them together, which might correlate them. And then I trace out some portion of this entire system. It might be the thing that I added on. It might be something smaller, something bigger. So I can end up with maps here from a small system to a large system or from a large system to a small system. But, and again, I'm not going to try to prove this, every achievable map can be written in this way. The reason we know this is that maps that cannot be written in this way always turn out to do nasty things like give you negative probabilities for measurements at the end. We call these things completely positive trace-preserving linear maps. The completely positive simply means it doesn't ever give you any negative probabilities. So this is a sort of foundational result in that it tells us what the possible maps are, but it doesn't necessarily tell us what the achievable maps are. In other words, there might be things that are theoretically possible that we can't practically do, and that's what I'm going to talk about quite a bit more. Okay, question was brought up, what about measurement? I've completely left out measurement here because I really wasn't thinking of it, but measurement of a quantum system is another primitive in quantum information theory. I'm honestly not sure what the best way to think about measurement is. This is curious because it's what I do professionally. So I think it's somewhat problematic. In quantum information theory, measurement is very simple. It's one of these projective von Neumann measurements where you pick a basis that might be a degenerate basis, and you push a button, and you get a result corresponding to one of those basis states. And you collapse your system. Sorry, the system magically collapses into that state. This is the picture that we usually look at it. I would say at least 50% of the quantum information community is actually really curious about how measurement really works beyond the sort of Copenhagen-y, well, this is an effective description of the system. But since I'm wearing my quantum information hat today and not my quantum foundations hat, I'm going to stick to the party line, which is you push a button and you get an outcome and the state collapses. So that's the canonical way of looking at measurement in quantum information theory. I want to make one final comment before I move on to sort of more interesting topics, which is if you had to know only one thing, one property of quantum states, the most useful one, the one that shows up, in my opinion, most broadly, is the entropy of a quantum state. So this is directly analogous to the Boltzmann entropy, or that is Boltzmann, right? Anybody up on their stat mech? Is it Boltzmann or Gibbs?
Okay. Boltzmann's H-theory.
All right, I've heard both Boltzmann and Gibbs, so I give up.
It was one of those stat mech guys who defined the concept of entropy that everybody uses in stat mech, and this is actually exactly the same, but we've applied it in a different context. This is usually referred to as von Neumann entropy for a discrete density matrix, and it's simply, if you write the density matrix in its diagonal form, every Hermitian operator can be diagonalized, so it's got some eigenvalues. Those eigenvalues we treat as probabilities, and then we sum up the expectation value of the log of 1 over the probability. This is one of many measures of uncertainty or disorder for a quantum state, and it's probably the most useful. And I'm not even going to try to scratch the surface of why it's the most useful. There are others that are used, but this one shows up all over the place. Two useful properties. First of all, if I have two density matrices, rho A and rho B, corresponding to different systems, if I stick them together by tensor producting, then the entropy of the joint density matrix is the sum of the entropies of the individuals. So this tells you that entropy is, in some sense, an extensive quantity, which is nice and useful. And the other thing is that if I have a density matrix, rho A, whose entropy is 0, then I immediately know two things. The first is that the state of row A is pure, and the second is if I have a joint state of row A and, sorry, joint state for two systems A and B, then it has to be a tensor product state. In other words, they're uncorrelated, which is a pretty useful thing to be able to say. Okay, there are two kinds of questions that we tend to ask in quantum information theory. The first is what kind of correlation, so the key thing here is correlation. What kind of correlations can you produce and what can you use them for? So given a certain set of resources, and what the set of resources is depends on what question you're asking. People have spent entire careers asking the same question with different sets of resources allowed. Well, I have to do this manipulation with one arm tied behind my back and my left eye closed. Well, I have to do this without being able to reach further than 3 feet away from me. Okay, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but the point is there are many different resource sets corresponding to different challenges. And the first question we ask is, what kind of correlations can you establish between two quantum systems? The second question we ask is, what kind of correlations can you establish between two classical systems if you use quantum intermediaries? The first one is arguably more fundamental because we think we live in a quantum universe. And so by understanding these things, we understand the structure of the universe. The second one is sort of more practical for the simple reason that, as far as anybody knows, we, who are the people who are using these tools, are classical systems. And so we tend to be interested, at the end of the day, in establishing correlation between two classical people or between two classical numbers, that's computation, et cetera, et cetera. So this is just something to keep in mind, is are we talking about an end result, in which case it tends to be this kind of a question, or are we looking at building blocks for building up these quantum intermediaries, in which case we look at this kind of a question. Okay. So, what's the language of information theory? Well, you've all heard of bits, probably. As far as I'm concerned, a bit is just a classical system that's got two states. I'm interested in that because that's the simplest possible classical system that's not completely boring. A classical system with one state would be, okay, fine, we know it's in that state, let's go home and have a beer. So, here's a bit, the light switch. If I stick two of these things together, each one of them has two states, and two bits have four states. If I've got a four-state system floating around, like, for instance, this handy-dandy device, then it's just equal to one switch going crosswise and one switch going vertically. The point of this is if you have a system with a bunch of states, then you can embed that system into some number of bits. So this is why we obsess about bits. It's not because we really think that two-state systems are the most interesting. It's because we know that we can always write out some string of bits that describes any system with a finite number of states. And I made the argument before that systems with infinite numbers of states can be pretty well described by systems with finite numbers of states. So this is whence the massive focus on bits and later in the talk qubits comes. This is a four-state system that fits really nicely into two bits. If I've got a three-state system, which I'll call a trit, then I can fit it into two bits, but there's some space left over. I could represent each of these three states by one of the four states of that thing. And so to understand how much information is stored in, for instance, a three-state system, what we do is we go to the limit of many, many copies of each one of them. So for instance, I observe that one trit fits into two bits, but 10 trits can fit into 16 bits. And I keep on writing bigger and bigger equations here, and eventually come to the conclusion that the amount of bits that one trit is worth is the number, there's a ratio between the number of bits I would need to describe n trits as n gets really, really big. And this is just the log base 2 of the number of states. This is the simplest kind of data compression. I'm given a physical, so I talked before about transformations. What I've just pointed out is I can transform information that's stored in a stoplight into information that's stored in switches. It's not a very interesting one. There are much more interesting things like what happens if you have redundancy in your data, and now you get into actual data compression theory. That's one of the things I'm not actually going to cover today. Okay, so here's classical bits, yada, yada. And, well, the quantum version is qubits. So a qubit is a quantum system with two states, two distinguishable states. Example, so conventionally we call the two distinguishable states 0 and 1. However, you can implement this physically in a bunch of different ways. And there are intuitions that we use from several of them. The three most common are a photon, which has two orthogonal polarization states that can be distinguished, a spin 1/2 particle, which has two, pick any axis, for instance, the z-axis, it's got two spin states, one aligned with that axis, one de-aligned, or a two-state atom, which has a ground state and an excited state, and we forget about all the higher energy states. Each of these provides certain intuitions, and so if somebody's giving a talk and they start talking about the up state and the down state for a qubit, what they mean is they're thinking about it as a spin 1/2 particle. Of course, you can have superpositions of these two states, which is why a qubit is different from a regular bit. So you have a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and the conventional picture of that two-dimensional Hilbert space is what's called the Bloch sphere. There's a continuous manifold of possible quantum states. The nice thing is you can put them all on the surface of a sphere. So examples of potential states for a qubit, the zero state I'm going to write as a two-dimensional complex vector with a 1 here, and the 1 state has a 1 down here. These look just like classical states, but then I can have superpositions of 0 and 1 with arbitrary phases in front of them, including complex phases. So these six states, the 0, 1, plus, minus, plus I, and minus I state, fit on the Bloch sphere. Here's 0, here's 1, plus, minus, plus I, and minus I. They kind of trace out the corners, if you will, of the Bloch sphere. Of course, it doesn't have any corners, but that's beside the point. They span the entire Bloch sphere. These states, in particular, the computational basis states and the positive and negative superpositions of them, come up a lot. Same point as I made on the previous slide about bits. If you have some physical system that's not two-dimensional, then you can fit it into some number of bits. In other words, you can get any physical system this way. And when we're dealing with bits, if we're concerned about the transformations on them, a concept that, again, comes up all over the place are the Pauli spin operators, which we've reborrowed in the language of quantum information for systems that don't necessarily have spin. They could, for instance, be a photon, they could be a two-state atom, but you can still implement the same operators. I was about to say something that's not really accurate. If you're operating with each of these operators on a spin 1/2 particle, then they correspond to spin in different directions. For a qubit, these are unitary transformations that rotate the Bloch sphere in some particular way. They're the simplest example of quantum gates. Okay, so that's it for the overview of the background for quantum information, the jargon and tools. Now I'm going to try to say some more interesting things in the 15 minutes that I have to go. All right, so before I go on interesting things, any questions about the background? Did I skip anything that seemed to be particularly important? All right, in that case, we have 10, oh, yes. Yes.
Oh, there it is.
Okay, what I'm trying to do here is to pick a survey of hot topics in quantum information theory. So things that you might hear from talks at this conference, since some of the speakers who will not be named unless they happen to be Nick Minicucci didn't actually get me an abstract. I had to sort of pick what the this morning. No more comments from the cheap seats.
No more punchlines.
So, one of the interesting topics in quantum information theory is entanglement. What is entanglement? I actually think the next talk is probably going to say quite a bit about entanglement from a slightly more foundations perspective. So I'm going to skim over this. The simple answer is entanglement is non-classical correlation between two different quantum systems. For instance, the canonical example of an entangled state is an EPR pair, a superposition of the state where two qubits, which might be widely separated, are in their zero state or in their one state. You can also have different various other pure states that have exactly the same correlation properties. What you get out of this is correlation that is stronger than classical correlation. I'm not going to try to justify that except by saying these states allow you to violate Bell inequalities. Bell inequalities are bounds on how strongly correlated two classical systems can be. These are not the strongest correlations that you could have between widely separated things. For instance, EPR states do not allow you to send information instantaneously between two places. And in fact, they're not even the strongest correlations you could have without the ability to send information instantaneously. There are things called non-local boxes that intriguingly have stronger correlation than quantum mechanics. But these are the ones that quantum mechanics seems to have actually given us. For pure states, any state that's not a product state is entangled. That's pretty simple. You just ask, can I write my state as a tensor product of two pure states? For mixed states, it's not quite as simple. Entangled states are the ones that cannot be separated into a sum of tensor product states. This turns out to actually be extremely difficult to calculate. It's very hard to determine whether a given state is entangled or not. In fact, it's been shown to be computationally NP-hard, which means there's no efficient algorithm given a relatively small state to tell for certain whether it's entangled or not. This is one of the weirder things to me about entanglement. Yes? So a pure state is something that can be written as a Hilbert space vector or as the projector onto that Hilbert space vector. A mixed state is a sum of multiple projectors. So if you have a density matrix and it has a spectrum that's 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, if it has one eigenvalue, in other words, then that is a pure density matrix. Mixed states are just the ones that have more than one non-zero eigenvalue. And they represent uncertainty. I say, well, it could be this pure state or it could be this pure state. So the pure states are kind of an idealization. The mixed states are the things we actually deal with in real life because we're never completely certain. So an example, here's a pure entangled state. It's a correlated state between two parties. Here's a mixed state that is, in fact, so there's still correlation. If the first party is in the zero state, then the second party is in the zero state. If the first party is in the one state, the second party is in the one state. But that's a sum of two different projectors. So this is a mixed state, and in fact, it is separable because I can write it in exactly the form that I gave here. One of the basic principles of entanglement, one of the few things that we know because it's in the definition, is that entanglement is something that can never increase under local operations and classical communication. In other words, if two parties are separated, they send messages back and forth, and based on the results of those messages, they do something to their systems. If they start with no entanglement, they can never generate entanglement. If they start with a little bit of entanglement, they can never end up with more entanglement. And this is really the defining property of entanglement. I'm not going to talk about distillable versus bound entanglement right now. And in fact, I'm going to skip over decoherence as well, despite the fact that it's near and dear to my heart. The best known application of quantum information theory is quantum cryptography. Yes? That's a research question.
You just said more or less entanglement, so that implies there's some sort of quantification.
It's an excellent question. There are infinitely many distinct quantifications of entanglement. For pure states, there's a simple unique quantification, which is the von Neumann entropy of one party's reduced state. In other words, if you have a pure state, then the whole thing has no entropy. But if it's correlated, then each party has some uncertainty. For an EPR state, for instance, each party is completely ignorant of measurements on their local system. And the entropy of either party is the unique measure of entanglement for pure states. For mixed states, there is no unique measure of entanglement. You can show that different tasks require different kinds of entanglement that are measured in different ways. I believe we know that there are infinitely many distinct non-equivalent measures of entanglement. Can anyone confirm or deny that for me? Yeah. And we think that most of them are probably not especially interesting, but we honestly don't know which ones of them are useful and interesting. So it's a very open question. The structure of bipartite quantum states turns out to be pretty complex. And So that's not even getting into the complex question of multi-party entanglement between three different parties, in which case there seems to be lots of different kinds. So this is a scratching the surface sort of thing. Okay, very briefly, quantum cryptography. The point of cryptography is to transfer information from one party to another and keep some intermediate party in the dark. There are better and worse ways to do this. One is, for instance, a Caesar cipher, where I've just taken each letter and pushed it forward one in the alphabet. You can decode this one pretty quickly. So this is what I would call insecure. It's not a very good, successful technique for transferring information. On the other hand, if you use a one-time pad where my recipient and I share a set of random numbers, then I can use that to encrypt this message in a way that is unconditionally secure. In other words, there's no way to break it except by knowing my friend's secret key. And then there are schemes that are very commonly used these days for internet commerce, for instance, which are computationally secure, meaning in theory they could be broken, but as far as we know, it would take a very long time to do so. These might become computationally insecure if we build a quantum computer that can solve problems faster. And so the motivation for quantum cryptography is to use quantum states and sending them back and forth to establish an unconditionally secure link between people. So the basic principle of quantum cryptography is to send quantum states in different bases back and forth and use the fact that measuring a quantum system disturbs it. So in the commonly used BB84 protocol, I'm going to give about 20 seconds of detail to something that deserves an hour here, the sender randomly picks either the computational basis or the basis of plus and minus superpositions of those states and sends information in that basis and doesn't tell anybody which basis she picked. Her recipient picks one of the two measurements to make it random, and then later on they have a phone call and they figure out which times Alice sent the same basis that Bob measured. And the punchline to this is that if there's someone in the middle trying to eavesdrop on this, then they introduce detectable errors into this. And so what Alice and Bob can do is they can tell whether somebody was eavesdropping on them. And then they hash their key to get something that's guaranteed to be random. So to me, the most interesting thing about quantum cryptography is that it says that quantum communication between two parties is useful. I was going to talk a little bit about quantum communication and the capacity of a quantum channel, which is pretty cool. But actually, I'm going to skip right over that because I think I have about 30 seconds left. So I want to cover a little bit of computational questions. Quantum computer, okay, a classical computer is just a bunch of physical systems, a bunch of bits, on which you can perform what are called logic gates. You take a single bit, and you can perform a gate on that. This is the NOT gate that takes the zero state to the one state and vice versa. Or I can take two bits, and I can perform a combined operation that might correlate them. So this is a controlled NOT. I flip the second bit depending on whether the first one was in the zero state or the one state. So a quantum computer is really very much the same thing. It's just that your physical systems are now quantum two-state systems. And you can perform unitary operations instead of permutation operations on the states of either one qubit by itself or two qubits. So people tend to throw up circuit diagrams that look like this. And the idea here is that I've got five qubits. Time flows to the right. This is a single qubit unitary operation where I go in and I go bonk, and I rotate unitarily one of those bits. This is a controlled operation on multiple qubits. So depending on whether this qubit is in the zero state or the one state, something may or may not happen to these bits. At the end, we have, and thank you for pointing this out, we have measurements made on those systems that read out the output. This is an example of correlation between classical systems achieved by quantum intermediary steps. Because I've got something quantum going on in here, but the initial state was just a classical bit string, and the final state is read out from the measurement. And we use this to implement certain algorithms, in other words, to calculate certain functions on n-bit strings. The three canonical examples of things that a quantum computer seems to be able to do faster than a classical computer are, first of all, you can factor a very large number that's a product of two primes into its prime factors. And this appears to be, no, Drat, that's supposed to be a superscript. The amount of time that it appears to take on a quantum computer, if we can build one, is the cube of the number of bits required to specify the number. Classically, the best algorithm that we know after a great deal of searching is exponential in the cube root of the number of bits. So essentially, the difference is here, this is something that scales as n cubed, this scales as e to the n. The quantum algorithm is a heck of a lot faster. Of course, it requires building a quantum computer, which costs you a couple of billion dollars. It's also another algorithm that we have is the ability to search a database, or as I prefer to say, to invert a function. You're given some number x and some function f, and you want to find the value of y such that f of y is equal to x. So you're trying to invert some very nasty random function. Classically, the only way to do this, if it's a really nasty function, is just to try every single value of the of y. And I'm sorry, I should have not written this as n bits and this is order n. This should be given a value of variable x that takes on n values. Sorry about that. There's an exponential error in that slide. You can do this faster. This is a provable speed up, even though it's only a square root, which is not as powerful as this exponential one. This one we can't prove that it actually works. The other thing you can do with a quantum computer is you can simulate a quantum system. And I'm now going to skip all through all this cool stuff and conclude, having explained that quantum computers seem to give you a speed up. One of the really interesting questions that's going on right now, and I hope that we're going to have at least one talk at this workshop about this, I'm not certain, is where does a quantum computer get its power from? Why is it faster, assuming that, of course, it is faster? And there's an easy answer, which is, well, it seems to be due to entanglement inside the computer. Maybe it's quantum parallelism, the fact that you can be in many states at once. That there are several people in this room whose steam is coming out of their ears at that statement. Is it the ability to do arbitrary unitary gates on a big Hilbert space? What's really fascinating is that we have found several different models of quantum computers, radically different looking things. For instance, measurement-based quantum computation, where all you do is you prepare a relatively simple state of a bunch of atoms or qubits, and then all you do is you make measurements on it. So that the picture here is a measurement-based quantum computer. You have an initial preparation step where you prepare an entangled state amongst all of these qubits, this big grid. And then you just start going, click, look at these two, click, look at these two, click, look at these two. And after you've made a certain number of measurements, your answer pops out the other end. So this is really weird because you don't have any dynamics at all. All you're doing is measuring things. There are other models of computation, quantum computation, that really sort of violate almost every idea that we have about where the power comes from. And so what I want to give you a flavor of in this slide is this is still a really active question, and one of the things we're doing is coming up with new and different models that turn out to be just as powerful as a quantum computer to figure out, well, if all of these things provide computational speed up, what's the common thread amongst them? Thank you.
Do we have time for one question?
Yeah.
Quick question. I don't know if it's quick, but when you do calculations on how long it takes to, say, factor a prime number, does that include error correction?
Yes. Error correction is important. I skipped completely over it. And the content of the fault tolerance theorems is that it is possible, if you have sufficiently low noise to start with, to put in error correction and do that error correction even with noisy gates and control, as long as your noise is small, and it only adds a relatively insignificant amount of overhead. By relatively insignificant, I mean a factor of 100,000 or so.
So it's not going to break the difference between a polynomial and an exponential?
Yes. Right now, the best theorems we have are if the noise is less than about 1 part in 10,000, 10 to the minus 4, then you can provably do this.
So the cluster model has something a lot better.
Yeah. So the best theorem is 10 to minus 3.
Oh, okay.
The simulations go all the way up to 1%.
Right. Okay. So yes, I'm sorry. It's 1 part in 1,000, not 10,000.
It's very architecture dependent.
Yes. Yeah. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons that we're looking at all these different models question is, well, we've got these different models. They all seem to be equivalent in terms of computational power. Which ones could we actually build, and which one would work the best?
Can I take another question? Why do you switch the computers? Is there any other question?
What class of functions does Grover's algorithm apply to?
Grover's algorithm applies to arbitrary functions. Any function that, any function that you can build an oracle, in other words, a black box that will calculate that function. So, for instance, you know, a computer that calculates that function would work. But the whole point of Grover's algorithm is that it's designed to apply to any function. Of course, if it's not an invertible function, so the whole point was to invert the function, then you may find that there's no answer, or that there are more than there's more than one answer. But there's no structural content to Grover's algorithm. And so it's designed to apply to unstructured problems, searching for a needle in a haystack.
But it's any calculable function, right? I mean, you can't.
Yes, that was the point of saying you have to have a black box that implements the function. But you don't even have to be able to.
But it's not magic. You have to be able to build something that actually does it.
Or be given something
right.
that you didn't build.
It's also worth saying that it's giving a square root speed up versus trying all the inputs to the function to see what works. It doesn't give you. It might be a better way of calculating the function, even classically.
It's the little blue button.